welcome to It Is What It Is. I'm Shaw Marie. Today's episode is picked by my very, very firstest ever fan tweet at Kenny. He made my day. He said my podcast was badass. For one, super, super sweet. Made my day, like I said, a million times, because he really, really did. And so I'm going to do the one that he wanted, because like I said, he's super, super nice. And first fan tweet ever. I didn't even know what the fucking icon was when it popped up. I was so shocked and confused. But, so, I used Murderpedia, Wikipedia, and YouTube for this. And I watched Unseen. It's a documentary that was done in 2015. You can either rent it on YouTube for $3.99 or watch the free version on YouTube. This bitch, all about free shit. So I watched the free one. I think probably the only difference is that like the lips are probably off some, but I went that way. So honestly, I can't tell you if there's a difference. If you rent it, or just do the free. Can't tell you. So he picked Anthony or Tony Edward Sowell, also known as the Cleveland Strangler. Sorry. Sorry, Boston. Cleveland. Anyhooser. He was born on August 19th, 1959. He was raised in East Cleveland. He is one of seven children, Jesus Christ, born to single mom Claudia Gertrude Garrison. Seven other children belonging to his sister also lived in the home with them, having moved in after the sister died of a chronic illness. According to his nieces, which testified to this in court, and if you want, you can go on YouTube and watch clips of his court hearings. There's like a bunch of different clips and like variations of like 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 15, whatever. But his nieces testify and stuff about his mom subjecting them to physical abuse while the other children watched from other rooms. In one instance, his mom forced one of his nieces to strip naked in front of all of the other children while whooping her with an electric cord until she bled. So his upbringing wasn't very good. But also, when you watch the documentary, his sister says that Anthony was different. Like, he was always overly aggressive, and like, he always said his mom didn't love him, but like, she always thought that it was the other way around. Like, he didn't show the mom the love that the mom needed to see, and that he was just a little fuck as a kid too. Like, she said that he would come at you as a sibling, he would come at you like a stranger. And like, she used the example of like, me and you are sister, okay? I would not fight you like I would fight a stranger. But he would go at his siblings like he would a stranger. So he just had no give a fucks about him, really. But he began raping his niece himself almost daily for almost 2 years when she was 10 years old. But thankfully, against his mother's wishes, on January 24th, 1978, at the age of 19 years old, Anthony entered the United States Marine Corps. He said that he went into the Marine Corps because he heard that because he had the choice between the Army and the Marines. He said he chose the Marines because they were, in his opinion, the stronger of the two. He attended training at a depot in South Carolina I don't want to mess this up, like Paris Island in North Carolina, I'm not sure. And then there was further training as an electrician in North Carolina. On January 13th, he was assigned to the 2nd Army Air Force craft. That's, I guess, pretty cool. At the Cherry Point Air Force Station, also in North Carolina. In 1980, he spent a year overseas with the 3rd Force Service, support group and then returned to Cherry Point. He was ordered then to the Marine Corps base in Okinawa, Japan, which is kind of cool because, side note, don't know if it really matters, but my sperm donor was in the Army and he went to Okinawa, Japan too for some training, which was pretty fucking cool because I got a fan out of the deal and some other little knick-knackies and some really cool pictures. So that was really cool. I guess he had a hoot too. I really don't know. Couldn't tell you, but just a little fun fact. In January, on the 20th of 1984, a year later, he was transferred to Camp Pendleton in California for 3 days until his discharge in January. On the 18th of 1985, during his 7 years in the Marine, as a Marine, he had received a good combat medal with service stars, a sea service deployment ribbon, a certification of commandment, I'm not sure what that is, and 2 letters of goodness on his behalf, appreciation or whatever. In 1989, Melvet, I'm hoping to God I say that right, Melvet, that's what it looks like, Skokwell was 3 months pregnant when she went to his home voluntarily, and when she tried to leave, he bound her hands and her feet with a tie and a belt, and he gagged her with a rag. She told the police that he choked her really hard and made her body start to tingle. She thought she was going to die. And she was a street worker. And she talks on the documentary for just like a brief little second. And she pretty much just tells you that like it doesn't matter what her career was, you had no, like, he had no right to be a fuck and rape her at knife point or destroy her life in any way, shape, or form, no matter what her occupation is. Everybody has an occupation. And that's just what hers happened to be. So why was she judged because of it? Which she shouldn't have been. Because, I don't know. He was a drug dealer too, so he was like hating for no reason. They're pretty much the exact same thing. Even though like a drug dealer isn't selling their body, you're selling something of a sort. You know what I mean? We're upon a mutual agreement that I'm going to offer you a service and you're going to pay me. I will give you drugs, you will pay me. I will fuck you, you will pay me. I will suck your dick, you will pay me. You know what I mean? Same fucking thing. Except for one gets looked down upon because she's fucking someone. Which is just horrible. Absolutely horrible. Her pussy, her right. She do whatever she wants. And that's what she says pretty much. And I stand by you. And I hope I pronounced your name right. So he was charged with kidnapping, rape, and attempted rape. He pled guilty to that. He actually pled guilty to attempted rape and assault. And that assault he served 15 years in prison. He was released in 2005. When he got out, he worked in a factory until 2007 when he began collecting unemployment benefits. His neighbors said that he was selling and living off of scrap metal that he would find. So he lived next door to a like sausage place, and they complained to the health department about a foul smell in the neighborhood, which no one knew what it was, right? So this sausage factory ends up having to pay like thousands and thousands of fucking dollars to get all their shit fixed because everybody's blaming them. It's fucking messed up. So he was online, Mr. Anthony. He goes by Tony, which I think I'm just going to call him Tony because it sounds better. I don't know. So anyway, He was online on some online dating services where he was, like, in his bio, he described himself as a master looking for a submissive person to train. So anybody brave enough, God bless. But Lori, a niece of the Cleveland mayor, Frank G. Jackson, she began a relationship with him shortly after his release from prison and resided in his home at, I think it's 12205, it's in here somewhere, in Cleveland. And she claims that the smell and stench of decaying bodies that they were told was, she was told that smell was coming from his mother, his stepmother. When she moves out, she claims the smell was coming from the sausage factory. Which, ugh, God, I don't even know. Now, there's different versions of why she stopped living with him. No one really knows at all. In a video interview, she mentions moving out in 2008. But in a published article, she said that she lived there up until moved out in 2007. And in another article, she says she's lived there up until 2008. So there's a year difference in her stories. In another article, a friend of hers says that she stopped dating him in 2008 for unknown reasons. We don't know what she saw, what she discovered, or anything. We just don't know. In September of 2009, he invited Lala, I cannot pronounce her first name, so I will go by what her nickname is, went to his home for drinks on September 22nd. She reported to the police that after a few drinks, he became angry. He choked her. He raped her. And he passes out. She passes out. Okay, so that's what they say. And then you watch the documentary, and she's on there for a good part. And she doesn't just, pass out. No. He thinks she's fucking dead. And she sits up on the floor, like straight, like coming back to life. Sits up, scares him, like shocks him. And he's like, oh my God, you're going to tell the police. And she's like, no, dude, I ain't going to tell nobody nothing. Like, I'm just not going to hang out with you no more. Like, she's like, oh, you're too crazy for me. And leaves. And obviously she goes and she gets her rape kit and everything else. Dude, it took the Cleveland police 3 fucking weeks to talk to her. 3 weeks to talk to this woman. And who came back to life. Just insane. So on October 29th, when they finally figure everything out and get all the testing, the police go to his house with a warrant to arrest his ass for the alleged rape. He's not home. But he was located 2 days later. So what they do find in the home, first they find the bodies of 2 women buried in shallow graves in the basement. 4 other women were found on the 3rd floor of the home in a crawl space in the house. After digging in the backyard, investigators found 3 more bodies and the remains of a 4th. Police also found a human skull in a bucket inside the house underneath the stairs. So that's 11 people total. The victims were killed by manual strangulation and others were gagged and had ligatures on their bodies when they were discovered. He had also had more than 3 rape victims that he actually had let live. All 3 never reported the attacks due to their prior drug history and personal choices in their jobs. Many victims were led to his property with the intentions of smoking crack with him. He was a known drug dealer throughout the neighborhood, so everybody knew him, everybody liked him. Nobody thought he was weird. Everybody really thought that he was a good guy that went to the Marines, served his country, and you know, was just a little weird, lived next to a smelly place, and went about his way. Everybody said hi to him, and I'll tell you about a couple of his victims that lived afterwards, well, his survivors afterwards from the show, and they all said that literally none of them had a bad feeling that anything was about to pop off until, like, right before shit popped off. Or, like, moments after it already went bad. So at the time of his arrest, he was 50 years old. He had been living at that house for 4 years. He was held on a $5 million bond, which is crazy because we have Lori Daybell bawling because she has a $1 million bond. This fool got $5 million. I don't see him fucking crying. He probably did. Who knows? His trial was originally supposed to start on June 2nd in 2010, but was repeatedly delayed first to September 7th to allow his attorneys more time to prepare, and then to February 14th, 2011, and then to May 2nd, as a request of his defense attorneys who needed more time to comb through the thousands of recorded hours of surveillance video footage from the property next door that shot onto his Imperial Avenue home, where the remains of all the 11 women were discovered, oh my God, were discovered in 2009. And later, it was moved to June 6th due to the prosecution, due to scheduling conflicts. It finally, eventually, well, according to Wikipedia, started June 6th, 2011. According to the documentary, started June 27th of 2011. So, dude, the sausage place was like no joke, okay? And they had 5 cameras, and camera 2 faced the like alleyway in his side house, and it cost $15,000 of the taxpayers' money to do that and go through that. So that is just awesome. So, one of his victims, if you watch the documentary, you can hear, she jumps out the window from the second floor, and this dude across the street sees it, and it's the first time ever in his life that he calls 911, ever. Her name is Shauna Morris. She never presses charges, but, when she falls out the window, he sees it, so he calls 911. And he's like, she just jumped out the window. And he's going crazy. And the person's like, is she breathing? He's like, it looks like it. And they're like asking him to go check on her. And he's like, oh, hell no. He's like, that's y'all's job. And you could definitely tell. He's like, I ain't trying to get in this, but like, she needs help. And when she wakes up in the hospital, she asks the nurse that she tells the nurse that she needs to call her husband. And the nurse tells her that her husband came with her on the ambulance. So he not only jumped butt-ass naked out the window with her, like after her, he rode in the ambulance with her, never got questioned, and then just dipped out. Like, I guess what happened was they were in the room, shit was getting crazy, she screams, he starts closing all the windows. She's sitting next to a window. She says she prays to God and tells God, hey, I'm about to jump out this fucking window, bro. Have my back. Jumps. And then you see her on the surveillance video, right? Just drop out and all naked. And then you see him come out of nowhere like a spider monkey, naked. Naked. And he like just helps her up and takes her back. And that guy's like, nah, she needs the paramedics. And so the paramedics come. And obviously she goes, she didn't wake up for 3 days. So I can imagine what that did to her. But obviously she lived. So that's what we need to focus on her case anyway. So he was charged with 11 counts of aggravated murder. And once again, according to Wikipedia, 74 counts. According to the documentary, 84 counts of rape, kidnapping, tampering with evidence, and abuse of a corpse. He pled not guilty by reason of insanity and later changed his plea to simply just not guilty. On July 22nd, he was convicted on all but one count against him, including the murders of the 11 women. So that's pretty awesome. On August 10th, jurors found him guilty of the death penalty. And on August 12th, Judge Dick Ambrose upheld the jury's recommendation. On September 14th, 2011, he was sent to death row. In November of 2011, his lawyers Jeffrey and Thomas filed a notice of appeals to the Supreme Court of Ohio, saying his execution was set for October 29th, 2012, but in March, a motion of stay was filed on his behalf from them. It was granted in April, pending a new deposition for the appeal. In October 2012, his new lawyers, Jeffrey and Erica, of the defender's office, appealed to have his conviction of the death sentence overturned to 21 points. I'm not sure what that means. With the three main things: that Tony did not receive a fair trial because the media coverage and attention for the case was overwhelming, and the local coverage was both good and bad, more bad in his way. He had received lousy legal representation. The courtroom had been closed to the public during the hearing. While the jury was picked at the evidentiary hearing, while the jury had been picked. So these are the three things I'm telling you why they say that they needed a new one. The third reason is the lousy the lousy lawyer from before. They say that their client pled to guilty to killing the women, and then focused his previous lawyer just wanted him to plead guilty and just forget about it and just do the death sentence, and that's not okay, according to the new ones. So, oh, goodness. And this is their efforts to prevent him from getting the death penalty. In 2014, the courts asked both parties to address those three issues. On April 5th, 2016, the Ohio Supreme Court heard arguments from both his appellate attorneys and the DA representing the state of Ohio regarding those three things. The defendant's right to a fair trial, they say, was, his team says, that it would win against his Sixth Amendment right was violated by closing the hearing to the press, and that the court should have communicated his death sentence to life in prison as the fact that the Ohio courts urged them to do so. Like, I don't know. Like, they say that it should have been commuted to the life imprisonment because of the violation, but that, I don't know, it makes no sense. Sometimes Wikipedia makes no sense to me, and I ain't gonna lie. So, like, when I read it, I'm like, well, that makes no sense. But I mean, it makes sense to them, because, like, even his attorney says, frankly, we blew it, in quotes, is what he told the Supreme Court. Is like, in their first go-around, it was, no one did the right thing on Anthony's behalf. No one explained why he became the monster he became. And obviously those are factors. So that means he shouldn't be put to death. He should just be imprisoned. And that's where his new site is coming from. so hopefully I made that make sense. The new side says the old side that he had was bad because they said, just go die because you did do these crimes. The new team says, well, don't go die. Go die slowly in prison is what they want. So there we go. The state argued that his amendment right was violated to the, was not violated, sorry, and was not, and had nothing to do with the outcome of his case, which I happen to agree. Just because you didn't let the court, like, you didn't let people in so people saw his sadness, I guess, the sad childhood he had. I don't know if that's really what they want people to see, because I don't know why you would want the courts to air your shit on TV. I don't know why, but I mean, hey, fight whatever you can fight. And like, when you're in this position and you're on death row, really any argument is a good argument. So I can't knock him. And just because it doesn't make sense to me, doesn't mean it wouldn't make sense to me if I was the one sitting on death row. So he never denied his guilt in any of the things. He always said he didn't remember what happened and that he would have nightmares of what happened, but like, he claims that he would go into like a trance and a fog. When the police were searching his house, he met up with his sister like 2 blocks away and was like, just so you know, it is true. I did do all this shit. I don't know why. My head's fucked up. Like, I'm fucked up in the head. I don't know what to tell you. So, anyway, that's a little side note. On December 8th, 2016, the Ohio Supreme Court said, we don't give two fucks. They said that his murder conviction and death sentence is upheld and will continue to go through. And so he appeals his case to the U.S. Supreme Court. In October of 2017, the U.S. Supreme Court said it would not review his appeal and they would have nothing to do with it. In February 2018, the Ohio Supreme Court again denied his request to reopen. So they're pretty much telling this guy, no, we will execute you, and he has to run out his chances. So he's going to die in Ohio in the penitentiary. So, the victims. On November 5th, 2009, two of the 11 women were identified. The first to be identified was Tanya, a 53-year-old African-American woman who was disposed of more than a year earlier. Oh, had disappeared more than a year earlier. Her body was found buried in his backyard. She was disposed of in the backyard. She had been strangled, and she was identified through her DNA. Her mother was the one who had reported her missing in December of 2008. The second victim was identified as Talika, a 31-year-old African-American who disappeared 5 months earlier. Although she had been missing since June, her mother did not report her missing until she heard the news coverage about the bodies being discovered at his house. On November 8th, 3 more bodies were identified. Crystal, who was a 38-year-old African-American woman who went missing in May of 2007. She was the mother of 7 children who lived in the area where her body was discovered. Her family reported her missing in Cleveland to the police department. This was the first time she had gone missing, and her family accused the police of failure to investigate, which they really fucking did. They messed up on her horribly. The family took it upon themselves to set up flyers and call hospitals and morgues and other things like that. Her kids had a very rough relationship with her. Her son recounts that for about a week and a half, him and his sister for breakfast, lunch, and dinner shared peanut butter. Like spoons of peanut butter for a week and a half. That's all they had. They would meet up at school and like eat a spoonful of peanut butter together and then go back to class. And her son says that the day before Mother's Day, he talked to her, but he didn't call her on Mother's Day because of their relationship. And then he tried to call her, and then that was it. So she went missing the day after Mother's Day, and then was found in his home. Amy Hunter was 47. She was an African-American woman. She was a mother of three, did not live in the area, but she did frequent that area quite a bit. A previous injury left her unable to use her arms. Oh, use one of her arms. Sorry. Her family did not report her missing until the police began removing bodies from his home. Michelle Manson was 47 years old. She was an African-American woman who was last seen in October of 2008. She lived in the area, according to police records. Her family had reported her missing. Reports of the missing person go back as far as June 2005. Released from prison, when they started searching his DNA and conducting DNA tests. They hope that in time, if any other missing or murder cases around that time lead to him, that this way they will have all that they need. East Cleveland police also reopened several old cases, like I just said, from the 80s. Murder by strangulation or some type of method in that area. And that had stopped around 1989, at the same time of his arrest. The FBI at the time gathered information to see if he had been linked to any other cases around the city, but so far none have been picked. Like, we haven't been able to pick him for any of them yet. So, like I said, Crystal was 35. They think she died in May of 2007. Tanisha was 31. They believe she died in June of 2008. And she actually has a very cute story. I just want to say real quick. She spent a lot of the time with her man. They were homeless together. And there was this one winter where I guess they would walk clear across town. And he would wrap his feet in plastic to keep his feet warm. And he had given her some money to go get some boots. And she came back with a pair for herself and for her man, because she wasn't going to walk across town and let her man freeze. And he sat there and cried. And it was just very, very, very sweet. That was a very sweet memory for him to share with everybody. Victim number three was LaShonda Long. She was 25 years old. They believe she died in August 2008. Her mom talks about how it's... she can only imagine the stuff her daughter was doing because she suffered the same disease, and that her mother suffered it, she suffered, and her daughter suffered the same disease of addiction, which is a very powerful, powerful disease. Michelle Manson was 45 years old. They believe she died in October of 2008. Tanya, 53, they believe she died in December of 2008. Nancy, 43, April of 2009. Miss Hunter, 47 years old, April 2009. Mrs. Forreston, 31, June 2009. Janice Webb, 49. June 2009, Kim Smith, 44, July 2009, Diana Turner, 38, September of 2009. After his conviction, in December of 2011, his former residence at 12205, Imperial Avenue was demolished on order of the city leaders, and he is still waiting his death sentence to be withheld, to be upheld. And while I was Googling this and everything else, I came across a handwritten visiting application for sale. You get the envelope and the application with him filling it out for $105. If anybody wants that. So, one of his survivors, sorry, I don't mean to call you victims, you are survivors, is Gladys Wade. 6 women died after she reported her rape to the police and nothing was done on her behalf. Vanessa Gay, when she was little, she wanted to be a cosmetologist or a welder or a trucker. She had big dreams in life. So what happened to her was horrible. Not only was she raped and violated in the most horrible way, but she saw a headless body in his house. And she said that, like, when they left, she walked arm in arm with him because if she thought if he got behind her that she wouldn't make it out of that home. And I could only imagine the fear and, like, I can't even imagine. And like I said, Lala, it took them 3 weeks. 3 weeks for the police to call that poor woman back when she just awoke from the fucking dead. Convinced him that she wasn't going to tell anybody. Got to leave. Reports it. Goes through the trauma of having that rape kit and everything else done. The pictures, the scrapings, the stories. I can't even imagine horrible looks that she got because she was known around that neighborhood. And they interview some asshole guy, the guy of the sausage shop or the convenience store. But anyway, and he says that he wishes that there was 100 more people like Anthony so well, because they were taking out the garbage, and that he recalls Lala's son coming in with a crack pipe asking him for the thing to make a new one. And so he says that, like, Anthony wasn't doing anything bad but taking out the trash of the neighborhood, which is a horrible, horrible way to think. I do not think that way, but that's just the way he thought. And that's, like, his anger towards them was that they were drug dealers using their bodies to get more. I mean, drug users, sorry, not dealers, but users. Shit, they might have been dealing. I ain't gonna knock you. But, like, I guess that was his main thing, is he was mad that they were selling themselves for drugs or whatever while having kids at home or whatever. And really, like, is it any of your fucking business how fucking people feed their children? You know what I mean? As long as that baby is being fed and looked after and she don't leave him in the playpen while she goes and fucking does what she does, then by all means, boo, you do you. Fucking make your money. No one should ever tell anybody in this life or the next life or the life after that how or what to do with themselves. Honestly, it's none of your goddamn, like, it's none of your fucking, I don't even know. Like, to come at me for choosing to make easy money. I mean, I know it's not easy, obviously. The task at hand is not an easy task, but easy money. You make a lot of money doing that stuff. So, I don't know. It's just, So, according to my man Ken, he says he thinks that Anthony Sowell is like Ted Bundy. And I agree. And I don't. I mean, I do on the fact that, like, he was very, like, charming. And he did, like, lure them in and everything else. But I don't. The grossness of, like, keeping all those bodies and, like, people. This neighborhood smelled so bad. Like I told you, this company spent thousands on redoing all their shit, and the neighborhood still smelled bad. Even the asshole on the documentary says that, like, his trash was stinking, and he went out there and there was trash bags with duct tape on them, and they smelled really, really bad. So instead of calling law enforcement or doing anything a normal person would do, he tells his coworker to go and dump bleach and try to get rid of the smell. So, like, I don't even know. You stink up a whole area. Like a whole fucking neighborhood, dude. A whole area. And it was really weird. So this bishop talks on there, and I wish I would have wrote his name down. I tried to go back, but I couldn't find it. But anyway, this bishop talks on there, and he says they were walking the neighborhoods one day trying to just spread the word, and they came to the corner of where this shop is, and they just had this sudden urge to pray. And he said they prayed long and they prayed loud, and it was like people that normally you wouldn't think in a million years would pray with you stopped what they were doing and just came and prayed. Obviously, we know now that 11 beautiful, beautiful women were murdered in that house, and so that was obviously what caused them to stop and pray and just have that moment with them and bless those souls that shouldn't have been lost. And it's just absolutely horrible. And just so y'all know, I did say some last names because I do not want to butcher their first names, and no, it's not because I'm racist and they're black and I can't say their names. But really, guys, I'm just like, I'm not gonna, you know? Like, I'm not gonna try and, like, slaughter it when I know I'm gonna, like, not say it anywhere close to correctly. And I'm, like I said, farthest from the racist. I'm never gonna be right. I'm like, I'm not. So, I'm sorry if that offends you. I'm deeply, deeply sorry. I just don't want to offend anyone by not pronouncing their first name correctly. So, hopefully, Kenny, you like it. Message me or tweet me again and tell me if you do because you made my day. Hopefully, I did you justice and you like it. Follow me on Instagram at it is what it is. Pod 19, and that's all together, no spaces, no nothing, just all together. On Twitter at it is what it is 208, because that's where I'm from. On Facebook and YouTube at it is what it is, a true crime podcast. And when I did my research on Thursday, I had 83 subscribers. Today and Saturday night at 11:42 p.m. I have 86. So, kind reminder, when we get to 100, I get my own www. Very, very important. I want my fucking own www, guys. I want it. And it's mine. And it should be mine. So, if you guys know a couple other people, make them subscribe. Help me. Because I love you. All of you. Every one of you. And yes, I do think that Anthony Sowell is a very troubled man. A very, very troubled man. I get some kind of sick joy, though, knowing that he claims he has, like, vicious, terrible night terrors about these murders, and that these women come back and, like, haunt him. And I hope that's true. I hope that wasn't to, like, get sympathy with the police, but I hope it's true. I hope you are haunted, Mr. Stillwell. I really do. And when you die, I will inform the world about your execution. So, you know, we'll see you when we see you. And I love every one of you. So, peace out.